Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and from lead issues in Illinois communities and more prominently in Flint, Michigan, to ag runoff issues in Iowa, and just headlines just this week of some water issues over in the Des Moines area. Clean water continues to be a problem vexing far too many communities in our region and nation. A recent book, which I just finished up, highlights a long battle that pitted average people on one side and a large coal company on the other in a poverty-ridden area of West Virginia. It's an interesting story and worth telling and worth comparing, I think, to some of the issues we have in our region. Chris Marr, the author of the book, who's a Wall Street Journal reporter, he's based in Pittsburgh, and he covers environmental, economic, and political issues. The book is called Desperate, An Epic Battle for Clean Water and Justice in Appalachia. And it's a really good read. I recommend it. Chris, thanks for being on.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate your interest in the book. Great.
Yeah, it's a traditional story, the good guys, kind of the bad guys. But I thought you were fair, very fair and even-handed. But I'm curious, you know, you're based in Pittsburgh, which is some of the area, steel, coal, some of the traditional industries that we've had. But what got you focusing on this story in particular to write about not only in the journal, but produce a full book about?
Yeah, thank you. So I was reporting for the journal back all the way back in April of 2010 out of Pittsburgh here. And the Massey Energy Upper Big Branch mine had a massive explosion and accident, and I went down to West Virginia to cover that. In the end, 29 miners were killed there, and so I really got more involved with covering Massey Energy, the coal company. At the time, it was the fourth largest coal company in the U.S., and also more interested in environmental issues and water issues, especially in West Virginia and this region here. And so I was just on a call one day with the source, and at the end, the source said, I know you're interested in Massey Energy. You should give this lawyer down in Williamson, West Virginia, a call. He's been suing the company in a water contamination case, and it sounded really interesting to me right away. It was one of those things at the very end of the call when someone just mentioned something almost offhandedly. But in any case, I went down and I met with the lawyer, whose name is Kevin Thompson. He was working out of the Mountaineer Hotel in Williamson, and just to give you a really brief synopsis of the story that's in the book, it really covers what happened in four old coal mining communities in southern West Virginia, Minto County, where the well water that was feeding people's homes went bad, beginning in some cases in the 1980s through the 1990s, and people had just been living with this water that was black, in some cases smelled like chemicals. They had to bathe in the water, you know, people were getting different kinds of illnesses, and really, really struggling with the water, and they couldn't get anyone to help from the state or the local government. And so eventually they turned to a lawyer whose name is Kevin Thompson, and in 2004 he sued Massey Energy, which had a coal subsidiary, a coal company nearby, these four communities. And the story is really covering this 7-year legal battle between the people who live in these four communities, Walwood Creek, Merrimack, and Sprigg, and Massey Energy, this most powerful coal company in West Virginia and Central Appalachia.
Well, you do a great job of getting into the history of the area, which I found just fascinating in two chapters. And I've got to have you talk about that a little bit before we get back into the crux of the story, because it is relevant to the culture of the area and the battles that ensued. But this region is famous for one of the famous feuds in American history, but also a massacre that, you know, I really wasn't aware of till about 10 years ago, where our government got involved on the side of companies. But if you could talk about those a little bit, just as they relate to the culture of the region and the larger narrative in your book.
Sure. Yeah, I really wanted to look at how this environmental fight, this water contamination lawsuit fit into the larger context, the history in the area. So in Mingo County, these communities outside Williamson are about 90 miles south of the state capital, Charleston, and it's a beautiful, rugged, remote area, very hilly, and, you know, it's been a coal mining place since the early 1900s. But as you said, it has this incredible history that's often marked by violence. So in the before the coal companies came in the early, late 19th century, the Hatfield-McCoy feud took place right in this area up through the 1880s. And it's also where the May 1 massacre took place in 1920 when the United Mine Workers of America was trying to organize the coal fields in the southern half of West Virginia. So it has this rich history of the feud, which I think has often been misunderstood and sensationalized, and which I try to look at from a different perspective of, you know, what was happening at the time right before the coal industry came in and transformed this whole region, this river valley that's right alongside where West Virginia and Kentucky meet on the Tug Fork River. So what was taking place there, and also in the 1920s, which is commonly referred to, you know, the Mine Wars era, when the UMWA was trying to organize and this massacre occurred in the town of Maywan. You know, kind of why did that take place there? And then, you know, sort of how that history is kind of embedded in the DNA of the place and in people, because their grandfathers, their parents in some cases, but, you know, their grandparents or great-grandparents were involved in these other fights between the people living in the community and then the coal industry, and what are those dynamics that are still in place today?
It's interesting because it obviously has the issue of coal mining has much relevance today as our country is moving towards a clean energy future. We still have those who are protective of the coal industry. But it's interesting back then how coal was kind of the economic lifeblood of the region. But then here there are environmental issues associated with coal. If you can get into a little detail about what was happening, you talked earlier about it to some degree, but just share how bad this was and what caused this issue to arise to prominence.
Yeah, so this was the mystery that the lawyer Kevin Thompson had to uncover, and that kind of gets unraveled through the course of the book. But basically, Massey Energy is this huge coal company, or was at the time, but it has all these subsidiaries, and one of their smaller companies was called Raw Sales and Processing, which was located right by these four communities just over a ridge. And they had a coal processing plant where they had to clean the coal before it could be sold to customers, steel companies or utilities. And so when you do this cleaning of the coal, it produces this what's called slurry, which is this toxic black sludge, coal waste, and companies had to store it. So often it's stored in an impoundment, which is just, on the surface, it's sort of a lake. It just holds, it's a holding pond for the slurry. But what Kevin Thompson discovered here was that the company had been injecting it. It had been pumping it down into the abandoned mine. So, you know, from those early days of mining, which started right after the railroad came through in 1892 and these coal mines sprang up along the river, the hills had been mined for decades and decades. And by the time, you know, in the 1980s, much of the coal was gone and the company was able to put the slurry into those mines. And Kevin Thompson argued that the slurry had leaked and gotten into the aquifer and eventually reached people's wells and, you know, came out in their taps, and people had been drinking it and not always knowing it, because, you know, even though it was in some cases black or rust colored and had a smell, sometimes, you know, there are contaminants that you're not aware of at the time, like arsenic, which is colorless and, you know, odorless. Yeah, this is this whole kind of puzzle that Kevin Thompson had to put together. And throughout the whole thing, you know, Massey argued that it didn't affect any of the wells. Its own experts said that the slurry would be contained in the well, in the abandoned coal mine. But Kevin, on the other side, Kevin had all these experts also saying that there were cracks in the rock strata, there were mine fires and all sorts of things that would have led the slurry to leak out into the aquifer and eventually get into people's homes.
You mentioned Kevin Thompson, who's one of the major protagonists in the book, several times the attorney representing the folks living there who's poisoned. The other major protagonist is Don Blankenship. Some of our listeners may have heard of him. He had kind of a chaotic run for president, but he's the CEO of Massey. And I thought you did a really good job of, again, it would be very easy to beat up on this guy and in some report facts and in some cases where he is beaten up on. But I think you also do a fair job of describing him kind of as a product of the region. And I talk a little bit about his background and his arguments or his case for on behalf of Massey that this pollution of the water did not occur or wasn't the fault of the company.
Yeah, so thanks for saying that, by the way, because I did want to bring out the complexity of the people involved in the lawsuit, including Don Blankenship. And so to me, he's just an utterly fascinating person. He grew up in Mingo County in a small place called DeLorme, which was right on the, again, it was right along the river next to Kentucky. And he grew up, he said it was an incredibly dangerous place. There were all these beer joints where he used to, as a boy, go and kind of watch his bar fights break out. His mother, who raised him, she was a single mom, she was a McCoy, so he's basically a McCoy living on land that was formerly owned by Devlance Hatfield. So again, there are all these links back to the history. But, he had incredible success at Massey Energy, and in order to kind of paint him as a more three-dimensional person, not, stereotype, I wanted to describe his childhood and his early career. Even before he became CEO of Massey, he had a 10-year career in the food industry, actually. And then to look at, what decisions did he make with inside the company and talk to people who worked with him. But basically, he remains this imposing figure, especially in the community. So in Mingo County, in southern West Virginia, at the time of the lawsuit, he was kind of respected by many people and admired, but he was also feared by others and possibly even hated by some people, too, depending on how they might have felt about the company or the coal industry. So he was CEO during this whole lawsuit, and he was also... In writing the book, I actually got to spend some time with him. He was generous to me in that sense, where he kind of drove around where he'd grown up and four communities and some other places in the area. And what I found remarkable is that, even though he is this, as you said, he's this notorious executive, nationally, when I would walk around with him on the street, sometimes people would come up have really complimentary things to say to him and, thanking him for the careers they had in the coal industry or, saying he'd been mistreated by the media or, so really, really interesting figure. And, that was one of the things that did drive me to want to write the book, was just how interesting Kevin Thompson was and Don Blankenship, and then to have them together in this one story was kind of remarkable to me.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Chris Marr, who's the author of a book called Desperate, An Epic Battle for Clean Water and Justice in Appalachia. It's a very, very interesting story. Chris is also a reporter for the Wall Street Journal based in Pittsburgh, and I think our listeners would enjoy reading about a book. Again, it's got, kind of the good guys and bad guys. You can pick out who you're for, but it's as we've just been talking about, Chris was talking about the bad, so to speak, bad guy, Don Blankenship. Really, there's an aspect to him. He certainly didn't have to talk to you for the book, and he did sit down and talk with you. And I thought it was fascinating towards the end when he runs for the U.S. Senate, you had a conversation with a woman who hated him, hated Blankenship, the CEO. But here again, his grounding in West Virginia and the fact that they knew him locally and all, she winds up voting for him for the U.S. Senate.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty remarkable, too, and I made sure to include that because I think it represented not only her feelings, but how many people in the area feel about him with these complex feelings. And it was just really interesting that she sort of viewed him on the one hand as just a person who lives in the community. And in fact, I don't think I said this earlier, but he, Don Blankenship, you know, he grew up in Mingo County, but he also lived in one of the four communities that was suing Massey. So he lived in this, in this community called Sprigg, and it was a house on a hill that was the old coal mine superintendent's house. So it was not, you know, it was larger than everyone else's house and surrounded by a black gate and everything, but he was a member of the community in many, many ways. And, so she viewed him that way, but she also saw him as the CEO of the company, and she kind of distinguished those two parts of him in her own mind, and you know, wasn't as nearly as forgiving when she viewed him as the coal executive who had made decisions that she thought endangered her water and her health.
One of the most interesting details and facts to come out in the course of the trial was that, and Thompson seemed to think that it would be strong evidence for his case, was the fact that Blankenship got his water from a different source. Can you talk about that just a little bit and whether that really held up as a key part of the evidence?
Sure. That was a major point that Kevin Thompson planned to present to the jury, and he made it numerous times in hearings in front of the judge, which was that Tom Blankenship, in this house that I was just describing, got a water line from the town of Matewan. Again, that's the town that where the 1920 Matewan massacre occurred, with the union organizing site that's very close to that, and the water line was run from the town to the country club across the street from Blankenship's house, and so he had it extended to his own house. It's interesting that, you know, in one of the episodes in the book, Kevin Thompson deposes Blankenship, and so they're in the same room together, and Kevin's asking him questions about the water line. And Blankenship said that he always just wanted to get city water because it would be better than well water generally. He didn't, you know, he denied that it was that he got water because his own water was causing problems to his health or anyone else's health in his home. But having said that, it was something that everyone in the case, and there was over 700 people eventually joined this case in the four communities, they would look at this and say, how can he have city water and everyone else is relying on water that, you know, frankly, they couldn't drink after a while, too. So it was a very dramatic point. And it's something I asked Blankenship about when I spoke to him, and he said that, you know, he said he didn't think that the company's operations had contaminated the water in the area, and that it had been degraded over time by all that those decades of mining that preceded Massey's efforts. But it was definitely a major point in this entire case, and you know, it showed the way, again, this sort of this power dynamic between the company and people who live in the communities, where the company was able to get water from the city, but everyone else struggled for years to get the state to pay for a water line, which ended up only costing about $3.5 million. So, you know, not that significant in the state's budget.
Take us through, if you can. We've got a limited amount of time on the show here, and this is a very, very involved case, and you track all the ups and downs and the delays. It took 7 years, as you mentioned earlier. But try to summarize, kind of taking us through the trial and then the result, and then we can go from there and kind of talk, look back at it and kind of analyze it and what it means for, in a broader sense.
Yeah, so 7 years. So from 2004, that was the first lawsuit that Kevin Thompson filed. Both Kevin and the people that he represented went through a lot in those 7 years. I mean, there were many hearings. There was one day in particular that I just want to mention because it was this time when the judge in Mingo County had tried to settle as many cases as he could. You know, there's over 700 people in the case, and the judge said, okay, we're going to bring everyone here in one day and try to, you know, shrink this case down to a more manageable size. And it ended up, this settlement conference, people had 2 or 3 minutes to meet with the judge, and they felt they were getting these really lowball offers from the company. It went from 9 in the morning to about midnight. It was a hot day. People were passing out in the courtroom. One person went into a seizure. And, you know, it, in a way, that kind of, people felt that that was almost re-traumatizing them, you know. But it was indicative of what people went through over those 7 years, I think. That kind of, know, and you mentioned the delays, so there were numerous trials that had been scheduled and delayed for one reason or another. One reason was just because the case was getting so complex. There were hundreds of thousands of medical records, experts, and everyone had to be deposed in the case. So just incredible. And Kevin himself went broke several times. He never thought this case would last 7 years and never thought he'd be living and working out of a hotel in Williamson for so long. And, you know, it was kind of really, it was very striking to see his office in the hotel on the fourth floor in this room that was kind of, you know, covered in posters and mind maps and wood paneling. It was like this little startup office that he had with these young, young staff that he had working for him who were kind of just, they had experience in community organizing, no legal experience whatsoever. And they basically lived and worked out in this hotel. He called them the hippies. So he basically had these Kevin Thompson and these hippies in an old hotel doing one of the biggest coal companies in the country. So, yeah, so 7 years. In the end, the case was settled. And so they never made it to trial, where, you know, Kevin and his team and the people really wanted this entire story to be aired publicly, which was also another reason why I was glad to be able to write the book, because I feel like, you know, this is an opportunity to tell a story that was never aired in court before a jury and, you know, never reported on the stage at that time. So, yeah, but I think, you know, as you mentioned before, it's kind of a mixed result in the end. There was a settlement, people got paid, but a lot of people were not happy with how things turned out, you know.
Yeah, it's... And for those, I just looked up that Mingo County, folks, is about 25,000 in population. So this is a smaller rural community. There's a lot of different elements of the story that we probably won't get into today. But you've got, you know, the smallness of the county. And you've got a judge who kind of does things in a shady way and on all the little small town connections that make justice sometimes very challenging. So, but it's a great story to, and it moves right along. I think.
Thanks. Yeah, I appreciate that. There are a lot of ins and outs, and it's a complex story. And, you know, just another level of complexity that the judge ends up getting recused from the case by the state Supreme Court, and they appoint a panel of judges to take it over, and that causes another delay. So, yeah, there's a lot of that it goes through over those 7 years.
When I got done reading it, I mean, it felt like in boxing terms, a split decision. Some folks got some money. They didn't get nearly as much as they wanted. Some of them were mad at Thompson for not coming through. Others were grateful. There was a health fund that was set up. What was your take? I mean, was it seems like, and I don't want to belittle the amount of money that was awarded, but it seemed like the little guy got screwed again just for because of the complexities and the nature of our judicial system. Is that a fair take on it?
Yeah, I think a split decision is a great way to look at it. I mean, you know, so there was Kevin Thompson and his partners reached the settlement in 2011 with Massey, which by then had come under new ownership. So that's another complexity we won't get into. But, you know, and you know, Kevin did not get his dream of putting Don Blankenship on the witness stand or, you know, holding the company to account in a courtroom. But one of the things people have to remember too is that even if he had won that trial, the company would have appealed, and that appeal could have lasted for years and just dragged on for a long time as well, which has happened with other cases against Massey for more than a decade. Case that went to the Supreme Court and got tied up in appeals for a long time. So in that sense, there was some justice, I think, because, as you said, people did get paid. They were more upset with how the money was distributed. But I think that often happens in these cases, from what I've been reading about some of the other big settlements that have occurred around the country. And the thing is also that some people who were part of the lawsuit died during those 7 years, and you know, people who were involved in the case said other people might not live to have seen the final outcome if there had been appeal. So in that sense, I think that, you know, there was some justice done. And just to add one other thing, when I went down to the communities recently and I delivered some books to people, one of the people I spoke to is a pastor named Larry Brown, and he's featured throughout the book, but he turned to the last page of the book and he pointed to it and he said, this should say to be continued because, you know, people are still dealing with health issues and the slurry is still in the hills and, you know, can break out at times and run to a creek. And, so the story for him is not over. And his take on it was that people did eventually get water. They did get clean drinking water. And that was the biggest victory for them.
I only have time for one more question here, but I have to just provide a teaser for our listeners. There's a fascinating story at the end where Thompson and Blankenship sit next together on a plane after all this is over. And it's kind of a civil discussion. But and Blankenship, after the book is written, goes from running for office to jail over another incident. But what I want to close with is this, Chris, just what are the broader implications we should take away? You know, that West Virginia is a ways away, but what makes this story compelling to our listeners out here in Iowa, Illinois?
Yeah, so I think one lesson is just in how prevalent drinking water problems are across the United States, especially, well, before the book came out, but even after, I've been hearing about all kinds of issues, you know, apart from coal and lead, but things with agricultural runoff and algae and, you know, other types of, well, PFAS, for one, is a major issue, which we definitely don't have time to get into. It's very complex, too. But just that, you know, just how pervasive things are. And also, I think, you know, what goes into just how hard it is to really find out, not only to hold a company responsible, but to find out what happened years or decades ago. I mean, it took Kevin Thompson years of deposing former company executives, digging through company documents, and as I said, you know, going broke and working out of this hotel for years, just to understand what happened, and then also to keep fighting in a courtroom against the company. So, you know, hopefully that might be inspiring to some people in other communities as well. See that people did finally have their voices heard and get some measure of justice out of this.
Well, it's a great story. Most great books involve great stories, and you've done a great job of telling this narrative. And again, for folks in Iowa dealing with ag runoff, in Illinois with lead, there's other clean water issues. I think the book is a worthwhile read. Chris Marr has been my guest today on Heartland Politics. He's the author of a book, again, the title is Desperate, An Epic Battle for Clean Water and Justice in Appalachia, and he's a Wall Street Journal reporter, and we'll continue to follow the work that you do. Chris, thanks for being on.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org. in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.